rise. Foyer. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is again in session. The Honorable Lawrence B. Hagel presiding. All who have business before this court draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Morning, everybody. Just trying to count to see if we have a 70-foot hour or if we gained any or lost any. And anyway, we are going to now take a matter of Butts v. McDonald. Document number is 14-3019. Now, in the previous cases, I will in this case also have would like to inform counsel that we've had two on-off decisions today, arguments today, I should say. We are going to try to hold very strictly to the time that you have available for the install for each side. So I would ask that you consider that, and of course my colleagues I think will attempt to do that also. We don't want to cut off any very important questions, but I think it's important for us to do so. Okay, who will speak for Mr. Butts?
Your Honor, Zachary Stoltz, Chisholm, Chisholm & Co. Patrick, and with me at counsel's table, Robert Chisholm.
Thank you. And who's that?
Your Honor, it's Brent Boker and Kenneth Walsh from the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chief Judge Hagel. Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Mr. Butts is a prevailing party because the parties specifically agreed in this case that, quote, vacatur and remand are warranted because the Board's decision finding that referral for an extra schedule order rating for the service-connected disabilities on appeal does not comply with the requirements of 38 CFR Section 3.321. The Veterans Cure, a joint motion for partial remand, which this court granted, in which he obtained a remand, requiring further agency proceedings, because of the Secretary's error. The Secretary argues today that this joint motion for partial remand was premised on, quote, a change in law. This is not true. First, the parties noted at page 2, the joint motion for partial remand issue in this case, that the Board did not comply with the Secretary's regulation. Second, and to the extent that the joint motion for partial remand cites to the Johnson decision, the case does not change in law. The Supreme Court in Rivers v. Roadway Express and the Federal Circuit in Panther v. Shinseki made clear that a judicial interpretation of a statute is retrospective in nature. This case involves a plain reading of the Secretary's regulation, but Mr. Butts' reasoning for declaring that he is the prevailing party is the same. The Federal Circuit in Johnson simply articulated what the plain language of Section 3.321 has always said. To the extent that this court's case law is an opposite to that of the Supreme Court and the Federal Circuit, those cases, as we submitted in our supplemental opinion, we identify Sachs and Fleming, should be overruled. It is the Secretary's burden to demonstrate that he was substantially justified in his positions at the administrative and at the litigation stages. Under the totality of circumstances test, the court must look to see if the
attorney argument earlier, did your distinguished colleague agree with the bus with his proposal that some outside intervening view supporting the Secretary's position rendered them substantially justified? Am I fairly stating what you're...
My understanding of what my colleague was saying at that point was if there was something outside of this current appellate litigation, perhaps,
that would have some bearing.
But in your case outside the Johnson case?
It was, it is a different case, but it is still part of the, at the time, the secretary knew that Johnson was on appeal. And so I don't know if
it doesn't like your vote, your counsel, it does matter to you that it's still on appeal?
I think that if we're talking about substantial justification, I think that the fact that it was on appeal is a factor that the secretary would have to overcome in showing that he was substantially justified. I think that it is something that needs to come into play. Again, if the secretary were to assert that, or assert something different than that, I think there's something that the court could possibly have to consider.
Mr. Stoltz, ask a little bit about prevailing party status and JNPR. Is it your position that any JNPR would amount to prevailing party status?
No, Your Honor. I think that the AJNPR, I think that there are examples that this court has pointed to in the past that did not result in prevailing party status. For example, a G remand or something that would go back for just a procedural type of matter. I think that the case law really does speak to that. So Mr. Butts would not submit that every JNPR automatically means something to the prevailing party for the purposes of EJIP, but that in this case, because it's going back for a substantive matter, namely compliance with the plain language of 3.321, it is in fact, Mr. Butts did in fact prevail.
So is the magic language in this JNPR, you're saying this is a narrow reading, as I understand it, would be the fact that it is going back for compliance with 3.321.
I think that language is dispositive. I think that does it.
Is there other language that might say that as well?
I think that going back for compliance with the court's decision in Johnson is also enough to establish prevailing party, because Johnson simply articulated what the plain language of section 3.321 is. At the end of the day,
Federal Circuit Johnson 2, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor, Johnson 2. At the end of the day, no matter how you slice it, the joint motion for a partial remand here sent this case back to the board for proper compliance with section 3.321's plain language. No matter how you dress it up, that's what is happening. And that has to have been an error by the Secretary for prevailing party purposes. The Secretary, essentially moving back, if I may, to substantial justification, to the extent that the Secretary, and again, this is the Secretary's burden, to the extent that the Secretary offered a substantial justification, it mirrors that of what he offered in his prevailing party status, in his prevailing party argument. He took a position that Johnson was a change in law and handed down after the Board of Veterans Appeals decision in this case. That, for similar reasons to why Mr. Johnson's the prevailing party, is simply not enough to substantially justify him, and my colleague spoke to that at some length before. But again, Johnson 2 is an announcement of what the law always meant. Under the Patrick decision, and under Rivers, and I understand that Patrick is a substantial justification case, and Rivers didn't necessarily deal in each context, but both of those cases do talk about the fact that in order to be substantially justified, the Secretary would have a very hard time overcoming the fact that the court announced what the plain language of the statute has always said. We would submit that same analysis applies to a regulation. We can certainly admit that the regulation is issued here and not a statute, but the same analysis should apply.
Can I interject with a question? In the board decision that was on appeal, did the board cite to Johnson anywhere?
It did not.
Do you have any indication that it relied on Johnson, the Johnson 1 of this court's decision?
No.
Does that play any sort of factor in whether Johnson was really even an issue and should make them, like, it's something that they should rely on because it was a precedent of this court?
Yes, I think it speaks to their justification at the administrative stage. I think that it is important
There's no indication that they relied on Johnson, and so there's no indication that that was any justification for their decision. The board really gave no justification for its decision to parse out each individual disability. So yes, Ron.
Well, if the board is presumed to understand the law and know what's out there, and the board's applying its regulation, as the secretary says, it's always been interpreted, what difference does it make if they cited to Johnson or didn't cite to our Johnson, excuse me, this close Johnson?
Because we're talking in these
cases. They added one line and said, oh, by the way, the board has other votes. That makes a difference.
It may. It may make a difference because, with respect to Your Honor's question, this is in the substantial justification context, which is entirely the Secretary's burden. The Secretary offered no justification for his administrative action, which is an important point that I don't believe he can overcome.
But didn't the Secretary say that they relied on the precedent? And if the precedent is Johnson, it's not clear to me that they relied on it, because they say that they relied on Dunn in the board decision, but it doesn't say they relied on Johnson in the board decision. So that's why I think that is an interesting question.
Yes, I agree with Your Honor that it is important to determine whether or not the Secretary was substantially justified in the administrative proceedings. And I think that it points to the fact that they were not, that the Secretary was not.
Had the board relied on Johnson 1,
would it make a difference? Had the board cited to Johnson 1, said that they're allowed under that decision to parse out individual disabilities, it may make a difference. I think the fact, if they were to do that, the board would be recognizing that, and the secretary would be recognizing that this was a case that had been appealed. And I think that would have to be a factor to be weighed as well, whether or not they were just going through this without hearing the last word, if you will, on it. I think that would still be a factor. But yes, to answer your question, your own question more quickly, yes, it would be a factor, but it's not the case here.
If you apply the Patrick analysis with a Johnson reference to the board decision, would you have a different outcome?
Yes, Your Honor. Because the Patrick analysis would say that it is very hard for the agency to overcome the plain language. Your Honor's question was whether or not it is a factor. I don't believe that it would be a winning factor. It may be a factor to consider, but I believe that under Patrick, it would still not substantially justify the Secretary.
Can you envision any situation that would envision a finding of substantial justification when the Superior Court has determined that the Secretary did not follow the plain meaning of this regulation? I mean, the Federal Circuit didn't rule it out. They just said it. They can't envision it at that point.
Honestly,
Your Honor,
in light of the answer, if it's a plain language case, I don't believe that there is a circumstance in which the Secretary can show that he was substantially justified.
In your research, and you haven't cited, and I assume it doesn't exist, but I just want to check, Circuit Court overturned by the Supreme Court on a plain meaning of a regulation or a statute. Is there any case where a appellant where the government lost in that case? They went to the Circuit Court, they lost to the Supreme Court on plain meaning. Is there any case where an appellant has been denied agent?
There is no case that we came up with in our research that would address that situation.
Which would what indicate that all ages have been approved? There's no denial.
There was no denial on the books. And if you're on like supplement pleading or something like that, we were of course happy to do it. For the reasons articulated today and in our pleadings, Mr. Butts is a prevailing party for each of purposes, and the Secretary was not substantially justified in his actions. He should be awarded each.
There are other factors, are not besides focusing on whether or not the Secretary on the merits was right or wrong to a reasonable position, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Would you address those other factors? Because it would seem that
is, would a reasonable person have come up with this conclusion or not, despite the wins or loses? So it's the totality of the circumstances that we have to look at now. And there are other factors. There may be others that are not stated in the case law, but the ones that are stated in the case law, can you address those, please?
Yes, Your Honor. The Secretary really didn't plead that, and it's the Secretary's burden of substantial justification. And I
understand it's the Secretary's burden, but I suspect I will ask the same question to the Secretary.
Sure.
And if you prefer to wait until a rebuttal, I'll be happy to let you wait, if that's your preference. But understand, I'm going to ask you to ask that question.
I'm happy to address it on rebuttal, Your Honor, but I would like to at least address the question if you don't mind. To the best of my ability right now, I have not heard from the Secretary, which is, it mirrors that of my colleague's earlier discussion, in that at the end of the day, it boils down to the fact that they're relying on the fact that this was a change in law, and that there was this court's decision in Johnson 1. And so it boils down, and there are the factors such as the genuine dispute, whether there was a long-standing agreement, whether there was a long-standing interpretation by the Department of Veterans Affairs. But I do not believe that the Secretary's actions, et cetera, at the end of the day, all that boils down to the fact that the Department of Veterans Affairs did not comply with the plan language. So 1 + 1 has to equal.
Does it all boil down to that? I mean, that's one factor, right? We've got to look at all these other factors to determine, because that determines whether or not what the Secretary did was reasonable, because otherwise, every single case would result in each of these whenever we are, for example, we are reversed, or any court is reversed. So I can't agree with that particular statement.
Okay, Your Honor, I'll do the best I can to address my colleagues. Answer that question.
Okay. Before you go, then, reiterate and clarify for me, what are the reasons the Secretary says? As I understand your argument, there are 5 or 6 reasons that you might use, or 7 or 8, totality of the circumstances. But the Secretary only cited to a few. What are the ones that the Secretary relied on?
Am I reading a change in law?
Secretary's right, is it a change in law? I submit that. Your view is it's not a change in law.
Yes, sir. And then they, in their latest pleading, they cited to the fact that there was this court's intervening.
Interview was on board, never even cited to that.
Yes, sir.
Have you got an additional view on that second one?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Is there an additional view on that second one? In other words, the board didn't cite to it. Did it matter anyway?
I apologize.
The second view is, I understand the Secretary has filed in their supplemental briefing that this court rendered a decision supporting the Secretary's interpretation, and somehow or another that provides substantial justification, is a factor in their favor for substantial justification.
Okay, Your Honor, yes.
One, you said the board didn't even cite to it.
No.
If they had cited to it, I believe, in answer to some questions, your position is it wouldn't have mattered anyway.
In this case, no, I don't think that it would have mattered, because the plain language is such a strong, part of the totality of the circumstances test. And not all of the factors, I don't believe, need to be weighed equally in light of Patrick, because Patrick said the plain language was such a strong factor. So even if there were other factors, of course, they should be weighed, but how much weight they should be given is an assumption.
And is there any other factor that the Secretary has cited?
I don't believe that.
Your understanding is those are the two the Secretary
has cited? Those are the two, as my understanding, what the Secretary is putting this from.
Judge Lance. Good morning, Counselor. How are you?
Good morning, Judge Lance.
Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Sorry. Explain to me again the fact that because the words Johnson and Lund were not cited in the board's opinion, somehow that has implications.
It has implications because it is the Secretary's burden to show that he was substantially justified in his administrative position, and he has not shown any substantial justification for the board decision that he rendered at the administrative stage. He just listed these things. He listed out the individual disabilities and provided the analysis, and so I think that it is a factor to look at when determining substantial justification, because there is no justification.
Well, but suggestion that the secretary needs to list every case that he or she relies on in deciding cases by the board?
No, but it's an important matter to consider when the secretary is getting before this court saying that he was substantially justified. They don't, the secretary, that would be a burden that they don't have to comply with to adjudicate cases, for example. Although I would submit in this case that there was probably a lack of reasonable basis, but that's neither here nor there. I think that if the secretary is going to get up in front of this court, say he was substantially justified, he's going to need to have that justification at his administrative stage somewhere.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Can you speak, Counselor, to some of the cases that the Secretary cites to find that his position was substantially justified, like Owen and Coleman and Clemens talking about the current law and the status of the law that existed at the time?
None of those, in our reading of it, I don't think any of those address the situation that we have here, where it was determined that the regulation's plain language always said what it said. Several cases cited by the Secretary had to do with the BCAA coming out during the litigation, so Congress changed the statute. So therefore, that affects both prevailing party and it affects substantial justification. But there were no cases that the Secretary cited that are specifically on point for what we are proposed for with today. To the extent that Sachs and Fleming do, there's not a lot of analysis in Sachs and Fleming that really speak directly to this, but to the extent that they do offer a prohibition, they should be overturned.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Chief Judge Engel, and may it please the court, the Secretary respectfully asserts that appellant is not a prevailing party, and that the court should find that the joint motion for partial remand is not based on the concession, either explicit or implicit, of administrative error, but it was instead based on a finding that based on the Federal Circuit's Johnson decision, their remand is warranted for the board to comply with the Federal Circuit's interpretation of Section 3.321b.
Let's talk about prevailing party for a minute.
Yes, sir.
Are there JMPRs that are reached where there is a concession for prevailing party?
Your Honor, the Secretary does enter into many JMRs where he explicitly concedes error in JMR, yes, sir.
It is not.
That he does, yes, sir.
He does.
Yes, sir.
But the magic language that you would use to make that concession is not extant here, is that correct?
I'm not sure whether there is any magic language, Your Honor, except for perhaps the explicit concession of error, which I believe that words that explicitly mean error would be used. But I don't think the issue of explicit concession of error is for application in this case, or whether there is an implicit concession of error. And Your Honor, the Secretary would assert that there wouldn't be any magic language to implicitly apply error. You would have to read the entire JMR without pulling any specific sentences out to determine whether there's error. For example, Your Honor, my colleague addressed the first sentence in the basis for remand of the JMR, which states that remand is warranted because the board did not comply with, that the board decision does not comply with the plain language of Section 3.321. That sentence is written in the present tense, Your Honor, and doesn't mean that the board's decision did not comply with the law as interpreted by this court's authoritative statement in Johnson 1 when it was issued. If you read that sentence in context with the remaining substantive part of the JMR directing what the board needs to do on remand, it's clear that the interpretation of Section 3.321 was due to the Federal Circuit's Johnson decision, which postdated the board's decision. The Secretary agrees with this court's holding in Sachs that it would be unreasonable to find error in the board decision when the board cannot anticipate changes in case law that occur after the board issues its decision.
I'll hold the change in law for a little later discussion, but what language have you used to explicitly concede error?
Personally, in my JMRs, I've very often said the word here, Your Honor.
Okay, and is there language that you have used to implicitly concede here?
I'm unaware personally of any JMR where I did that intentionally. I would like to address my colleague's statements regarding changes in law. The Secretary is not contending that the regulation changed in this case. What changed was the authoritative statement that was binding on VA. When this court issued its decision on Bach and Johnson, it was binding on VA prospectively and retrospectively up until the day that it was overturned by the Federal Circuit. And therefore, the decision that the board issued in this case, even though it did not specifically cite Johnson, it is consistent with this court's holding in Johnson. And there was no reason for the board to cite Johnson because Mr. Butts did not argue below that his various service-connected disabilities were inadequate on a collective basis. So, Your Honor.
So why did you agree to the remand? If there was no error?
Respectfully, Your Honor, it's not necessary for the parties to agree to an error to enter a remand. The appellant presented that argument.
In your view, was this magic type remand?
No, Your Honor.
The magic case, Federal Circuit.
I would consider it more of a remand than consistent with the Akers type remand that the Federal Circuit discussed, where the parties have entered the JMR based on a new theory based on controlling the case that comes out after the board decision is entered. It's not a remand on the merits because there was no concession of error in the JMR. So it would be, it doesn't have to specifically decide to the Najib.
So let's go to the question that was deferred. When a Superior Court, the final court, makes a determination that a regulation is plain on its face, you view that as a change in law? How do you square that with the case law that seems to indicate when you make a determination that is plain on its face, it's where it's been all the time?
We view it, Your Honor, as a change in case law. And the case law has the effect of being binding upon the agency. So it operates retrospectively, yes. And it does mean that's what it always meant. But up until that point, there was a different case that was binding upon the agency. And so it's not a change in law in the sense that it changed the words of the regulation. And it is the authoritative statement on what the law always meant now. But it is a change in the sense that there was a binding precedent that was, at that time, the authoritative statement on what the meaning of Section 3.321B meant. And that was the authoritative statement that was in place when the board issued its decision in this case.
Pat, you argue that the board relied on precedent in making this decision and that therefore the administrative position of the agency was justified. I don't know how I can know that the board relied on precedent when they haven't cited to any cases. Maybe you could say that they relied on Johnson. But when they do cite to one case, or sort of the expressio unis principle, they didn't cite to Johnson. So how should I believe that they relied on it in making their decision?
I believe, Your Honor, that if we said they relied on Johnson, it was a mistake. We tried to say consistent with Johnson, which is, if you look at page 3 of our pleading, it says the board issued. It was not administrative error for the board to issue a decision consistent with this court's holding in Johnson. If I think that we mostly stated it that way, and I apologize if there was a slip in one sense who said the board relied on Johnson, but our position is that the board's decision is consistent with Johnson. There was no need for the board to have cited Johnson for it to be consistent with Johnson.
Okay, well, let's assume that. I'd like to talk a little bit about Rivoto and Ramsey.
Yes, sir.
I know that in the past those cases have only been used when the Secretary disagrees with this court's decision and it's on appeal to the Federal Circuit. But looking at the language in those cases and in Tobler, it talks about the agency making a, you know, economical determination or its use of its resources. And so why wouldn't the agency in this instance need to request a stay in order to be reasonable and be protected from having to pay EJIA in cases when it's later determined that the plain language doesn't support their position?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, it was reasonable because Sachs and Fleming are controlling precedent regarding the case law.
I'm talking about at the time before Johnson 2 was decided by the Federal Circuit.
Exactly, Your Honor. Those cases say that a remand based solely on an intervening change in case law is not a remand based on error. It's a remand just for further adjudication.
And you don't think Patrick changed the landscape?
No, Your Honor. Patrick was not discussing prevailing party status, and the Federal Circuit has also relied on new case law as being a basis for not awarding prevailing party status. The Federal Circuit didn't address exactly the same situation in Akers because I don't believe it was a ruling on an interpretation of final language. So that this court's decision that the remand was based on Akers was based on a regulation that did exist, but the board had discussed, and that this court believed it could have offered a new theory based on that existing language and that regulation for a non-collection of a debt payment, I believe was the case. But I don't see how the Secretary would believe it was necessary for him to seek a stay when the controlling precedent in this court would say that prevailing party was not awarded based on change in case law. And one of those changes in case law is the Federal Circuit's overruling of Colvin v. Jawinski and Hodge, which was based on the plain language of the regulation in that case.
Well, that was many, many years later. So it wasn't that Colvin was appealed to the Federal Circuit, and
that's correct.
Colvin changed the decision. Colvin was changed. So I think that's apples to oranges comparison, perhaps.
I don't think that changes the fact, Your Honor, that this court's decision in Johnson 1 was authoritative when Mr. Buss's board decision was issued.
Okay, counsel, what do you do then with that? Maybe you answer that, I'm not clear. After the next point, that if this court had previously upheld an erroneous interpretation, that does not resolve the substantial justification inquiry. And even if the board, your brief says the board's decision is consistent Johnson, but suppose the board decision cited Johnson in light of Patrick, where does that take
you? Your Honor, I agree that Patrick is not dispositive. It says that the plain language is one of the factors that the court must consider for substantial justification. The Secretary does not think that Patrick is relevant to the prevailing party inquiry, but to the extent that the Federal Circuit ruled on the plain language, that is a factor that weighs against the finding of substantial justification on that element of the case. The Secretary does respectfully assert that whether a party is right or wrong does not ultimately mean that party is unreasonable. The Secretary doesn't believe that even in matters of regulatory interpretation, that's a zero-sum game. You're either right or you're unreasonable. You could be wrong, but unreasonable.
Do you have any case where the final court has made a determination that the agency did not follow the plain meaning of its regulation or statute, and each and the government was nevertheless found to be substantially justified? Is there any case out there?
Not that I'm aware.
So you're looking for this court to issue, in the first instance, a case that says, despite the fact that the Federal Circuit found that you didn't follow the plain meaning of the regulation, you were substantially justified?
Yes, Your Honor.
Even though they also said in that case that they found no policy reasons for your position.
Yes, Your Honor. It's the Secretary's position that reasonable minds can differ on that, even if the Federal Circuit was ultimately correct as a matter of judicial hierarchy in this case, or the Johnson case.
I think in your pleadings you said that that a question relating to Acres was currently on appeal in Robinson, I believe, at the Federal Circuit.
I believe the case name is Rodriguez.
Oh, Rodriguez. Thank you. Do you think that we should stay this decision pending that? Or stay in this case pending that?
I consult the counsel.
Sure.
Your Honor, the Secretary would have no objection to that. The Secretary believes that if the Federal Circuit issues a precedent, it will likely be either very relevant or dispositive to this case, and the Secretary has no objection to a stay, and it may be efficient to do so.
And right now it's in the briefing stage, is that?
I consulted with the attorney who is representing the Secretary, and he informed me that the Secretary's brief is due October 15th. That's the best of my knowledge on that.
Counsel, along with our previous case, I think it was a single judge case coming from our court. If I recall, there may have been a JMR or JMPR in there as well, but the language for remand was to consider Johnson 2. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. To the best of my knowledge, that's correct. I was not the attorney on that case, but I believe that it is also based on a board decision that was issued after Johnson 1, but prior to Johnson 2, and the remand was based on language related to Johnson 2.
Right, and which is different from the remand language in this case, that specifically refers to 3.321.
Yes, Your Honor, the language of the JMRs are not identical, that's correct. I want to address Appellant's point about this not being an issue of change in law. I just want to emphasize that the Secretary's position is not that the law changes. We believe this issue is not change in law, but change in precedent. The precedent from the courts is binding, has the force of law. The Secretary is not able to depart from those when issuing the board's decisions. So to the extent that change in law is considered to be some sort of magic word by him, by Appellant in his argument, that this falls outside of that. The Secretary believes that changing case law should be considered the same as changing.
Now you're arguing that this court's decision in Johnson was the standing precedential decision at the time the board decision was made, even though the board never cited to it.
Yes, sir.
And that the board decision was consistent with that. And that when the Federal Circuit came out with its decision, it was a change in that precedent.
Yes, sir.
That's what your position is.
That's our position.
Do you have other factors, counsel, under the totality of circumstances test, aside from this case law argument, that will help your position?
Under the totality of the circumstances, Your Honor, for the what was listed in our pleading was that we believe that our position, although it was wrong, was reasonable. Reasonable because it's consistent with the way that the rating schedule works. The rating schedules work, each disability is rated separately. So the section 3.321B requires you to determine whether the schedule ratings are inadequate. And it's reasonable to assume that because each individual scheduler rating is done separately to determine whether they are inadequate, and we look at that the rating schedule disability by disability basis. So it was the Secretary's position that his interpretation, although mistaken, was reasonable in light of the scheme of the rating schedule as a whole.
Is there more?
For this case, Your Honor, only that the law as it was existed changed after the
aside from that argument.
I believe that's all for this case, Your Honor. If there are no other questions, the Secretary has nothing else, Your Honor.
Supreme Court's decision, the first case that they took out of this court, involved 1151.
That's right.
And I believe the Secretary had an interpretation of the statute that it could require negligence on the part of VA before anyone could receive benefits under 1151. And Secretary lost at this court, lost at the Federal Circuit, and lost at the Supreme Court. Is that a position where the Secretary would be arguing that they were reasonable in interpreting the statute to permit them to add the negligence requirement? Or do you call it the Supreme Court?
Answering that question, so I don't believe that it should be a factor to be considered.
If there are no further questions, Mr. Buss does believe that it is a prevailing party, and the Secretary was not substantially justified in his actions.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry. Judge Lambs.
Counselor, are you familiar with this case that we're talking about where there's a stain involved?
Roboto and Jansi?
No, Rodriguez, I believe.
Rodriguez, yes, I am familiar with that case. Our firm represents Mr. Rodriguez.
Okay. Is that going forward on appeal?
It is going forward. The last that our officer was that the Secretary's meeting is due in mid-October. I do not believe that it is necessary to stay these proceedings. As Judge Davis pointed out, the language in the joint motion for remand is different. There are some slight variations.
Tell us what the issue is in Rodriguez.
The issue in Rodriguez, as my colleague pointed out, is that the Secretary has taken the position that Johnson was a change in law. Johnson 1 was out, and Johnson 2 was not out, and the Board of Veterans' Appeals rendered its decision that way. It is similar to...
It's not an agent case.
I'm sorry?
It's not an agent case.
It is an agent case.
It's on the agent basis?
Yes, it is on the agent basis.
And were they awarded or denied by the court?
Denied. By this court.
Denied by this court. Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. In a single judge decision. And it was appealed. There are some differences, and we allude to that in the letter that we filed with this court in May, but there are some differences in the joint motion. Litigation in this area, because it is evolving and the court has gone en banc, I do think that this court's decision in this case could, I want to choose my words carefully, could potentially have some effect on the way litigation is done. In Rodriguez, there's a case state as well called Roosevelt Stanley. It's a case that has been stayed pending Rodriguez. I think that if this court should promulgate a decision, I could never presume to speak for the court, a decision promulgated by this court in law could have an effect on what the parties end up doing in Rodriguez. I think that's something that is within the realm of possibility. I don't want to speak any more to it than probably that. But I don't personally believe that a stay of this case is necessary in Rodriguez, but that's for what it's worth from counsel.
The Stanley case that you talked about, is that stayed in our court?
It is stayed at the Federal Circuit, Your Honor.
And on what basis is it stayed?
It is stayed pending the resolution of Rodriguez.
And is that on the motion of one of the parties?
It was a joint motion, Your Honor.
Okay.
Is Rodriguez a prevailing part of the issue or a substantial justification?
It is both. As I recall, it is both. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Are there any further questions? Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is submitted, and I'll leave now.